searching for the mysterious Dargon, the intruder has already been spotted by Action Man's eagle eyes. The Action Man team set off in a grim race against time. But they are already too late. The dreaded Dargon has been unleashed upon humanity by the intruder. And it's up to the Space Rangers to stop him with their laser gun. With one blast, they halt the maddened Dargon in its tracks.
Action Man!
Another job well done by Action Man.
Everybody, and welcome to the latest installment of Pod Stallions, the podcast for the website Plaid Stallions. I am Brian, and with me as always is Jason.
Hello, everybody.
You kind of worried me there. I didn't know if you were actually there.
I'm here. Like it or not, I'm here.
We've got a special episode today in that we've done tributes to people before, but this is actually our first living tribute, knock wood, and that is to actor Tom Baker, who we are both fans from childhood, I'd say.
Yeah, and, I'd say that.
Not, you know, largely we knew him as the Doctor, but we've also come to follow him in his quirky and unique career. And he's also not only the only living actor we've done tribute to, but also the only actor I think we'll do tribute to that has a Human League song named after him.
I'd say that's a safe bet.
And also, it, I think the wonderful thing about Baker is that in tandem with him being a talented man, he's also quite a quirky guy, as we'll delve into.
Yeah, and I think this sort of came up because, well, I can tell you what put it into my head to kind of.
I think
throw
you
it
came
out
up with it, and I just said, yeah.
I think it was. It was a couple of things, and one of them was the I went to what's it called? Gallifrey 1 or Gallifrey 21 or whatever it was that I went to.
You went, I didn't.
Right, but it was. But is that what they're called? You know, is it Gallifrey something or whatever it was, 22 or whatever the hell it was? And it was out at near LAX.
Okay.
And I haven't been to such a thing in, you know, forever, and. I started looking at the lineup and thought, well, this would be really kind of fun to go to because, you know, Louise Jameson's going to be there and Katie Manning and, you know, Lala Ward. Like, you know, this would have been the kind of thing when I was a kid that I would have, you know, killed my family to go to. And so somebody got me a pass. It had sold out, but someone I knew got me had an extra ticket or something. So I went on the Friday. And then I came back on the Sunday to see a few other people. And I got a bunch of autographs and met Paul McGann and all the people I just mentioned and all that stuff. And there was also a huge table for Big Finish, which is the company that does audio stories.
Yeah, they do a great business.
They do. I can't even begin to think of how many stories are out there now because they were kind of getting this thing. They got this thing going in the doldrums, you know, when the show was off the air. And then once it started to build, and now I think they've done stuff with all the living doctors, plenty of people that are already gone. You know, Fraser Hines now does Troughton's voice.
No way.
You know, stuff. Yeah, and it's dead on. It's really dead on.
I don't think
on.
They do Eccleston, though. I think somebody else does Eccleston.
Oh, okay. So I wasn't sure if he had done it or not. But they had this huge table, and everything was, you know, a third off what it normally would be or something. And I'd never really heard any of them, and I thought, well, you know, I do voiceover, and we good to hear some of this stuff. And so I got a few, and mainly Tom Baker ones. And there is something a little... You know, a little strange about you can definitely tell the some of them, their voices have changed. Like Davison's has become very rough and gruff and low, much different than it was when he did the show. Baker's has become a little, you know, a little slower, I guess, but it's unmistakable. And I found that this was such a fun thing to hear. And then at the end of some of them, there would be interviews with him. You know, Nick Briggs would do a little 20-minute interview with him or something. And he's just as much of a lunatic now as ever. And his answers are so, you know, strange. And he always brings religion into it and the Bible and God and, you know, when he's going to die and all this stuff. And it just, I found it so charming again that I ended up getting one that was called Tom Baker at 80. And it was basically a two-hour, two-disc thing where Nick Briggs sits down and talks to Baker about turning 80. And it was really something, and some, you know, very sad and touching about, you know, his age and, you know, the people that have gone and, you know, the mistakes he's made, and, you know, and but some real, real great stuff in there. And I thought, well, God, why don't we do something on, let me just do an episode on Tom Baker, because it was, the show was clearly a big deal for both of us as kids. And, you know, it's, there is something about all of that that I just mentioned that really hits me in a mortality kind of way, that they're not, you know, he's not going to be with us forever. And he's, I think he's 83 or 84 now, I think.
You know, 83? I kind of knew it was coming, but in the 50th Doctor Who special, when you hear that, you know, I think you might.
You know, I think you might. Yeah.
Yeah. It just, it hit me right in the feels.
You know, I have to say, I had no idea. You kind of felt like something was going to happen. You did?
I read a thing that he might have a cameo. But, okay. You read all... Doctor Who is the worst for bullshit rumors.
For rumors, yeah.
And so I didn't... But when I saw him, it made me weepy.
Oh.
And, you know, because...
I jumped off the... I did. I got choked up. I gasped.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? This doesn't happen a lot, but I bought that on Blu-ray because I really like that special,
right?
And I will watch that scene because it's just so great. And he's still owning the show in that scene.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, Smith.
His little kick
kid.
And the finger on the lips and the little just these tiny little moments that he was able to milk out of that and go, that was who he was with that twinkle. And I'm, for one, I'm glad that I had no idea it was coming, because I had gotten so wrapped up in the show at that point that it hit me like a ton of bricks. Like I didn't see it coming, and just knocked me out. And you're right. I do get to that scene and I still get a little, yeah, oh my God, because, you know, it's not like that was something, do you know what I mean? Like certain shows and certain things and, you know, like even by the time, you know, Spock showed up in the second, you know, in Star Trek Into Darkness, he just kind of went, oh yeah, there he is again. We've actually seen quite a bit of him. This was the kind of thing that just, you never thought you'd see, that Baker was going to somehow be involved with the new show. And yeah, it was just glorious. And he's just, I mean, when you look at all the archival interviews that we talk about, all the extras and some of these DVDs, the things we find, whatever, he was never not interesting, you know, to be interviewed. A really, really bright guy. Probably
I remember
massive
there was a
pain in the ass.
There was yes, we can get into that. Now, I remember watching a PBS documentary on Doctor Who years ago, and I don't remember what it was called, but that was one of the things I was really excited to watch it as a kid. I remember it was quite boring.
And was it the Chicago thing? Was it that
I don't remember. I just, you know, PBS played it, and I was so excited, and I've never sought to look it up again or what it was.
Right.
But I can just remember Baker was sitting there, and he's being himself.
Right.
And he's, you know, and he was sitting there going, yes, of course I've read Stanislaus Lem. You know, like I could tell he was he's very smart. You know, he's an intellectual, and you know, I've having read his biography, and
yes,
there's I think the word madman kind of works for him a little bit.
I think he's, look, this is a guy that went into a monastery, mm-hmm. you know, and
yeah.
realized after a certain amount of time in there that this wasn't quite for him. And then he got some success, you know, in different productions and some TV things that he was in Nicholas in Alexandria, for God's sake. Like, that was a big part for him. And yeah. then all of it sort of just is a working actor. And then he's back to working on a building site.
Well, that's my favorite.
He gets Doctor
before
Who.
We get into how we discovered him, which both of us are going to say Doctor Who anyways, the most fascinating thing I find about him is he is not working at a construction site as a construction worker. He is the fetch it boy who makes tea for these guys and
right.
does other things.
Right.
So when they're trying to pick the new doctor, and I'm not sure, I think it was Barry Letts who picked him, right?
It was Barry Letts. It was, I think, his wife mentioned yeah. something or had yeah, seen him in something and said, what about him? Or
so while Tom Baker is toiling on a construction site, Barry Letts goes to see Golden Voyage of Sinbad.
That's right.
Which Tom Baker is the villain of the film.
That's right.
And chooses him based upon that. And that's mind-blowing. The man has a film in cinemas.
That's right.
And is working like basically a minimum wage job somewhere.
That's right. And I think Letts basically said it was playing around the corner.
Yeah.
Like, they literally left the office, went around to catch a screening of it, and it's extraordinary. So, yeah, so that would be, I mean, because we did an episode about Doctor Who and how we sort of discovered it. And
yeah, and this won't all be about Doctor Who.
No, but yeah, I think it's safe to say that the one thing I think that sets you and I apart the most of anything that we ever talk about concerning the show, past, present, future, whatever, besides the fact that you love Donna Noble, your favorite companion.
I know, I have nothing against her.
I'm kidding. Well, I do. I've got a few things against her. But the thing would be that you were aware of Doctor Who with Jon Pertwee, and I was
yeah.
not. That
yeah,
would
what, I would love to get to that. Pertwee came out, I think, 75, so I would have been 4.
Right.
So that show scared the crap. I remember Day of the Daleks. I remember the Three Doctors, which confused the hell out of me. But the one I really remember the best is John. Now I can't remember the name of it. What's the spider one?
Planet of the Spiders.
Planet of the Spiders.
The
one I remember best is
the one
where
the planet. What's the one called with the planets all spiders? They live there.
I'm leaving this in. but I remember very vividly watching the end of Planet. It scared the crap out of me. I remember my dad making fun of it, going, ooh, because, you know, to my dad, it must have looked ridiculous. But then the doctor dies and changes into this dude. And then what really freaked me out was TVO, who was playing Doctor Who, I think they just went right back to, like, early Pertwee. So,
oh, really? Okay.
It took, like, 2 years.
Oh, wow.
For me
Isn't
to,
that
you know,
funny?
Because, well, yeah, I also didn't know when TV was on. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know when shows were on.
But that's extraordinary to me because, I mean, you think about it, you had experienced Pertwee in 75.
Yeah.
I didn't see anything pre-Baker until about 85, until they did that. They repackaged everything.
Yeah.
And sent it to all the PBS stations, and suddenly they started way back at Unearthly Child, and yeah. they went forward through, and that stuff had never.
I can honestly remember watching the Peladon stories when I was in the fourth grade, so it was like 1979, 1980.
Oh, that's a trip. That's
like
that's
it was
crazy.
Mostly Pertwee, and then I think around 79 or 80, Robot aired. And
okay,
I remember.
See, we had, because I remember distinctly watching Battle of the Planets and then flipping over to watch Doctor Who.
Yeah, you got that package
so,
a little earlier.
Was that 77, 78?
That would have been 78, 79. No, I think 79 for Battle of the Planets.
Yeah, and so that we've talked about this before, but that's how I first came across Doctor Who, was just flipping
yeah.
around, and all of a sudden it was either Ark in Space or Genesis of the Daleks. I mean, it's such an early memory. I'm leaning toward Genesis of the Daleks because Davros
really Battle Planets was 78, so you're right.
Okay, so it was 78. And yeah. Davros really freaked me out. But I couldn't look away. And this was something that just became fascinating to me because I didn't know what this was, where it came from, who did it, why it was being shot this way. It just, none of it made it.
Why did they go outside and it looked different?
And at that point, the only thing I'd seen on videotape were sitcoms that aired at night. I didn't understand, or Python, you know, like I knew Monty Python at that point, but I didn't understand what this was. But somehow it fascinated me and scared me at the same time, and I just became, you know, entranced with it. And I don't remember what happened after that first run, but I think I just kept watching them. And then eventually it became that thing where in America they would run all four episodes together, like on a Friday night at 10 or something.
Yeah.
But there was a while there where they ran it every day, one episode. I might have even seen some of the ones with that, you know, where they had the guy that did the recaps.
Those would pop up occasionally on my PBS even.
Like I might have even just,
they would run one story with those weird Henry. I think his name was Henry something.
Henry Silva. No, that's not
Henry.
It.
No,
is it Henry Silva? Silva.
It is no. not. I think it's Howard De Silva.
Howard De Silva. You're right. That's right.
Yeah. And he'd be like,
so I think I saw some of those.
Doctor Who is on the planet. Yeah.
Yeah, and then of course, you know, as would happen with everything that we sort of started to fall in love with at that point, I then started to look around for stuff. I looked around for comic books or toys, especially anything to do with this show. And it was literally that,
there, dude.
Well, that wilderness of like, it really wasn't until the early 80s when a friend of my cousin's mentioned this magazine, Doctor Who Monthly, which was, you could only get it at certain
comic shops, you know, and stuff.
Slightly seedy sort of magazine comic shops where you don't go in the back room. But before that, I didn't really understand just what, you know, what was out there. And then that kind of started the catalog thing, you know, getting the catalogs in the back of Starlog and finding the words Doctor Who in there and then looking for stuff, these British catalogs and sending cash and all that stuff that we've talked about. So really from 78 to like 82, I'm completely unaware that there's anything out there. But the one thing that I had, I still have it. I mean, I have the very one that I had, but I've since gotten another version, was Fangoria, like issue 2 of Fangoria had a pullout, a section on Doctor Who and a pullout poster. You know, and you pull it out and it's fold out, Tom Baker holding his hat above his head, and then some of the creatures around him with the logo. And that was on my cousin could get Fangoria because I was too young for Fangoria. I would get Starlog occasionally, but I was too young for that. And he gave me the poster. And I had that poster on my wall when I was like 9 years old. I don't know how many kids in America have a Doctor Who poster on their wall, but that must have been a little strange.
I absolutely did as well, but I don't know. I think that was maybe the early 80s. There was also Famous Monsters was one of the few American magazines to actually put it on the cover.
Yes, and I had that. I had that as well. I don't know whatever happened to the one I had, but that color cover.
We used to get the annuals too here through. There's always, because Canada is a bit of a commonwealth. Like you were saying, you'd never really seen a show filmed like that. Well, TVO played a lot of BBC dramas. In fact, I think I've told you this in private, that they would just wheel in a TV with what the way they did was they would say it was educational, and what they would do is
take
like a BBC serial like Phoenix and the Carpet or Tom Grattan's War,
right.
And they would imbue it with an educational segment, so they'd have someone discuss storytelling.
That's or where you had
in Doctor Who's case. The Pertwee years were all hosted by a guy by the name of Dr. Dater, who would talk about the science of Doctor Who. And then the Baker years were all hosted by this woman, this kind of thorny woman named Judith Merrill, who would talk about science fiction and the science fiction. And she basically used to call Doctor Who crap. I remember that.
You sent me a couple of clips, and she has a tone where she's constantly sort of shaking her head like, no, doctor, sorry, There's only one galaxy or whatever she's around.
Well, I can remember actually the Seeds of Doom.
Like, you're kind of killing my buzz.
She had a panel of people going, well, this is just a ripoff of Quatermass. And I was, you know, I'm 9 or 10 watching this going, what the hell is Quatermass?
Yeah. Next week we'll talk about Battleship Potemkin and how it relates to the arc in space.
I can't imagine if she were alive today, how she'd feel. But
you're right. It was weird. That's fascinating on, because that reminds me of the stuff here with the Children's Television Workshop, with stuff like Sesame Street and Electric Company and stuff. And they would wheel televisions into classrooms. Especially kids that were a little behind or whatever. And that they were able to watch that half an hour out of their day and learn a little something along the way.
If your teacher was hungover, it was, you know, a little reprieve for them.
Right.
I remember vividly watching Robot, the first episode of Robot, with my sister. And we both were, like, the first 10 minutes going, I don't like this doctor. He's a goof.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
And then by the end of it, forgetting who John Pertwee was. I can honestly remember that. Like, I'm in.
Isn't that interesting?
And then I vividly remember watching Ark in Space. It scared the living hell out of me. It is still one of my favorite Baker stories. That Baker season, you know, there's a couple of clunkers, and I do believe Genesis of the Daleks is too long. I think Revenge of the Cybermen kind of... there. I think that's still one of the most solid seasons of Doctor Who ever.
Well, that's what I was going to add to when you started talking about Robot, was that, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we talk about, that you and I talk about in private as well, that you and I have the same kind of attitude where it's like, just because it happened when we were kids doesn't mean it's great, doesn't mean I love it. Like, you know, I personally didn't like The Dark Crystal. It's scared the crap out of me, and I have no affection. I don't dislike it. I don't hate it. I don't hate you if you do like it, but it just doesn't mean to me what it means to certain people. So it's just not like everything we look back on, we go, oh, that was the golden time. That was the greatest, the greatest thing ever, whatever. You know, we were really lucky. Well, at least I feel lucky. I mean, you had Pertwee, but I mean, my introduction to this show was Tom Baker and these shows, and I have gone back fairly recently to look at some of these, like Brain of Morbius and Robot and Ark in Space and things like that. First of all, I would say for the first time that I would kind of have to agree with some of the parents that were saying, this is if your audience was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 year olds, like, this was incredibly dark stuff. It was disturbing. Yeah. It was weird. There were heads getting cut off and limbs going weird, and, you know, all that stuff. So but it really, to me personally, is the high point of the entire universe of Doctor Who. The entire series are Baker's first couple of seasons. They are, I think, the most consistent, the strangest, and what's remarkable looking back on them, like how lucky I was that we got that first run, and that was our introduction. Because I look back on them now and you go, man, he grabs the part with both hands and just goes. And it's never, you can see him easing into it. But in hindsight now, when I have a better understanding, you know, years later and everything, just what came before him and just how big Pertwee was and what a big show that was, where his direction came from, where he decided to go with that and what he did. Do you know what I mean? Like, it really is bonkers when you look back on it.
I also want to think he invented the Doctor being weird after regeneration.
I think there was a little bit of that with Troughton, apparently, because I finally saw the animated version of whatever, but it's more that he's just silent. Troughton doesn't really tell you what's going on, and they're trying to make him sort of markedly different than the crotchety old guy from before. But I think you're right. I think that's that weirdness afterwards, and then trying to do something, a 180, you know, from the previous guy. Like, I think they did a really good job with that, with Eccleston, Tennant, And then Smith was, I thought, very different from Tennant. Like, he just, yeah. It was a different kind of energy. And then Capaldi, you know, not being a hugger and not being, like, they're pretty good about doing that here and there. Sometimes it gets a little redundant, but that had to be the biggest shift was, I mean, because at the time, Baker was, you know, when they say Matt Smith was, what, 27, 28 or something? Well, that would have been what Baker was like 40, I think, when he got the part. And it must have seemed like a universe apart from the other three guys that did it. And, you know, and even Cushing in the movies. Because he just bounces in with this energy that's... He's very self-assured. I feel like there's not a false step there. It takes him a couple of stories, but he dives right in. Don't you find when you watch
those? I think by Ark in Space, when he's giving that speech on the ship. I buy Doctor Who DVDs just like you do, and I bought a bunch recently because I had some medical procedures, and I thought I would just, you know, recuperate by watching Doctor Who.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, I end up eating the fries and leaving the sandwich because I love the extras BBC puts in there.
Yeah, me too.
I watched Ark in Space all the way through without commentary, without special features, just because it's still good. It's still really good.
It seems to me to be so above the audience that was viewing it or that they were playing it to. I'm not saying the kids weren't smart or anything, but it's clearly the show has now moved well beyond a kid's show. I mean, it did that years before as well. But Ark in Space, it's just like, you know, the dialogue, the concepts, the speech, the Homo sapiens. Speech that he gives. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. That's Bob Holmes, wasn't it? Wasn't that Robert Holmes did that one?
I think it was. And he delivers that with such gravitas that you believe it. And, you know, I don't love all of the Baker era.
Right.
I'm essentially a Hinchcliffe fan. And
I think you and I,
you know,
both,
I think he goes in with a roar with that first season, and I think his last season is, personally, I mean, I don't want to offend people, but I think that's a worse season.
His final season?
Yeah.
Oh, it just depressed me. It just, every story depressed me. And I didn't even know the end was coming. I didn't even realize that. Because even at that point, I didn't fully understand there were, because I wouldn't have seen any of the previous stuff, and I hadn't even picked up a magazine yet to know what the history was. So when he left the show in that episode, and Davis and Ellis, and I had no idea what it meant. I was completely confused, and I was convinced that he died, and I was kind of miserable for a while. That was, you know, it was only a year after Han Solo got frozen. It was kind of a traumatic couple of years for me. But
I don't think I saw that until high school.
They ran it straight through. They ran it straight through.
I don't think I got that till... No, you know what? I got that in 1983, so Han Solo was free from carbonite by that point. But the reason I knew that he was regenerating was I picked up the Doctor Who annual, the last Tom Baker annual. I picked it up at the Scottish Bake Shop in town, and I think I had an iron brew while I was there. And it's a picture of Tom Baker in a field holding some grass in a really, like, I didn't like his outfit, all red. And there's a photo of Peter Davison, just, and it's not of Doctor Who. It's just a photo of Peter Davison.
It's just it's that little round picture up in the corner, right?
Yeah, and it's like he's making a weird little face.
Yeah.
And I think the first couple of stories, there's one interesting comic strip with just the Doctor and Adric, and then the last story in it is the new Doctor.
Funeral.
and it's just, someone has, in the illustrations, taken that headshot of Peter Davison and drawn it. So you're just like, you know, and I mean, like, they're not going to write anything that makes you think this is the new Doctor or what.
Right.
It's a really curious thing.
It had to be Nathan Turner, because Nathan Turner was so ready for him to leave, for Baker to leave at that point. But let's go back just a few steps. So here is this thing that we're starting to understand as it goes on. This must be big. in England. It's getting a following here. I mean, I don't remember having maybe but one friend that would watch it that I knew watched it, so I was kind of on my own. But I'm noticing it in Starlog and things like that, and articles and pictures of him and things like that. And, you know, he's, you know, I don't think we really understood at the time, but he was a huge thing. Just how
up until the new show came on, if you said Doctor Who to an American, they would ask about a scarf, or you know what I mean?
Yeah. Nobody would really go anywhere else with it.
No, I mean, and to be perfectly frank, the follow-up doctors never filled his shoes.
No.
In the United States.
For various reasons,
the show got canceled, you know.
No.
But he was the height of the show's popularity, I think.
I think it was the perfect time, the popularity, the way a lot of those stories were written, and he was, no two ways about it, was a force of nature. I mean, he dominated those stories. And
yeah, he did. And if you look in pop culture, The Simpsons has had him cameo several times.
Right.
You know, I think there's an episode of Family Guy where they're in the Millennium Falcon going into hyperdrive, and it's Doctor Who's time tunnel, and it's Tom Baker's face comes through. I mean, he was the Doctor from, you know, 78 to about 2005.
Pretty much.
In the American's eyes.
I think it was a combination of the scripts changing, and it just, like, he just was, you know, a force
even,
of
even,
nature.
Even and, Doctor Who references him. Like, the TV movie, the 96 Fox TV movie, McGann's looking through lockers and finds a big, long scarf.
Well, look at the Matt Smith era. Who's the woman, the unit woman, the nerd girl with the glasses wearing a scarf?
Yeah, she wears the Baker scarf.
There was nothing else that there was that even came close to that kind of iconography, like the hat and the scarf and his whole vibe. But he came along and he just... I'm trying to put this into... I'm not explaining it well enough, but he just came along and it was like he indelibly put that stamp on the show. You know, erratic, quirky, goofy, not taking stuff seriously. You know, he did embody bits of the previous guys. He did take some of that. But he really wholly made it his own. Like, I was able to walk into that show having no idea what came before it, and I just accepted it, and it just was... And he just was this, you know, for better or whatever those stories were, whatever he ended up being as a person or whatever, he gave his all to every story, except, like you say, that last season was pretty, I think he was miserable. I think he was physically unwell. I think he, you know, they were looking for him to move on. I'm not sure if he really wanted to. And I think, you know, it's a miserable season. It's just freaking miserable. But other than that, he's, you know, and he seemed to give 1,000% to the show and the kids and everything else as well.
Yes, he did. He was even, you know, there's long talk of him being a bit of he liked to drink.
Yes.
And
he liked to go to the pub.
I think it's Matthew Waterhouse's book where I read an anecdote where he's throwing up in a parking lot. And some kid finds him and says, "Are you Doctor Who?" And while he's puking, he hands a kid a signed photo. Like, you know, he was very, very into the hospital thing. I don't know if somebody wrote Plaid Stallions once. We were talking about schoolyard rumors, blah, blah, blah. I was walking into school and someone said, "Doctor Who's in the parking lot handing out magazines." And he was like, "Whatever." And yet, sure enough, Tom Baker, full costume, handing out Doctor Who magazine. You know?
Wait,
you know,
in where?
In
was that the Ireland thing?
Yeah, like just... No, I think he was paid to go to schools in probably 78.
Oh, yeah, there's that footage of with him in Ireland going to those schools and handing out magazines and poster magazines and stuff. And those are the poster magazines that I tracked down. He was also, like, very aware that kids shouldn't see him with a cigarette, and that, you know, if he saw them at a pub, put the drink down or whatever. Like, he was he was very aware of that and his responsibility, he thought, to these kids and what this character meant to them. There's a great story he told once. Again, you never know with Tom Baker the way he tells stories how much of this is true or not. But there's a story that he tended sometimes to like to watch the show when it was going to air, and he knocked on someone's door. He was in the pub or something, and then he thought, oh, you know, I'm just going to go knock on someone's door. And he knocked on someone's door, and the door opened, and it was a kid. And he knew, because, I mean, it, you know, if the story is true, which it very well could be, you'd have to realize that at a certain point, just about every kid under the age of 10 at a particular time on Saturday was watching Doctor Who. It was a national pastime. I mean, his stories were getting, you know, 9, 10, 11 million viewers, I think, at one point in the late 70s. And he knocks on the door, and a kid answers the door, and he says, hi, are you, you know, hello, where are your parents from, whatever he said. And they let him in, and he watched an episode of Doctor Who with this family in their home. And the kid was, like, having palpitations because it was so bizarre that here's the guy at the front door. But it sounds like the kind of thing that he might have done. Now, it also turned out that he was, by all accounts, after the first few years, I think the drinking increased a bit. I think he got a huge swelled head that the show really was a huge part of tuning in was because of him.
Yes.
And I think he was very difficult to work with and rude to a lot of co-stars. I think he was kind of rude to directors and writers. I think he badmouthed the writing a lot of the time and probably was a genius to watch, and he always gave it his all, but
he's even mentioned that they probably weren't sad to see the back of me.
Yeah.
I personally feel like there's a tremendous dip in quality after Hinchcliffe leaves.
Yes, I agree.
I think Graham Williams really wanted, like, you know, I know he was bound by telling less violent stories, and he did that, but he also tried to tell huge stories.
Right.
And, you know, when the Doctor's running around, supposedly running around the TARDIS, and you can tell he's, like, in a hospital somewhere. It took away for me, personally.
They tried telling bigger stories, but they had less money to work with.
And then it devolved into semi-camp with, especially the Key to Time. And I'm not a tremendous fan of the Williams era. There's some bright spots. And like, my wife, who's slightly younger than me, she adores those years.
I've gone back and watched some of the ones that I haven't seen, like Creature from the Pit and things like that, and I forget just how much humor there was in there, because at that point Douglas Adams,
there's some really witty writing that went over my head,
was the script supervisor, but it wasn't, I think, after those first two seasons, you know, Seeds of Doom, and there were, it was a constant, it was him and Sarah
Terror
Jane,
of the Zygons,
Terror of the Zygons, you know. I even like the Android Invasion. I love that because it's just goofy and he's wonderful. And it just reminds me of these two people were constant. He and Sarah Jane. That was the unit to me. And some of the early stuff with Leela was good. And, you know, he's still not letting it go completely off the rails. He's still kind of doing what he did in those first few stories. But the show is kind of changing. It's getting more popular, but it's not quite what it was. Da, da, da. He also, at one point, I know you know this, but I think for the most part, his life kind of was Doctor Who while he was doing the show. I don't think he did a lot, much else. He might have done a play or two here and there.
He did some voiceovers.
And he did some voiceovers, but I don't think he did much else until after the show. But there was
at one point he was trying to even get a Doctor Who movie going.
Well, that's where I was going. There was a time that he and Ian Martyr had become pretty good friends, and Ian Martyr was the guy who played Harry Sullivan, and that, you know, he left the show after just a few stories, and he wanted to be a writer, and he ended up eventually, you know, doing some Target novelizations. You know,
he did the Sontaran experiment.
Yes, he did, and so they started batting around an idea called Doctor Who Meets Scratchman. Was
Vincent
something about
Price
the devil,
Vincent Price was going to play the devil, and
there were going to be scarecrows or something in there, or Daleks or scarecrows
But the one thing I remember is, because I'm fascinated with it, I would love to read that script. Something about the end of it, the movie was going to be a giant pinball machine. The Doctor was going to be trapped in a giant pinball machine. And it just sounds like it would have been like one of those kind of dark Amicus type productions. You know what I mean? Like kind of dreary. And so it would have been wonderful.
There's a lot of stuff that I've heard about it that you go, well, that kind of sounds interesting. Followed by a thought that you just go, where did that idea come from? Like it would have been an interesting, like it wouldn't have been a light, fun commercial film. It sounded like it was going to be very dark. And I think he had a dark sense of humor. He does have a dark sense of humor. I think he wanted to get, like, it never could have happened. This movie, you know, wouldn't have. I think some bits of it, oh no, I'm getting it right. There was something, Douglas Adams had something to do with something at one point, or a Doctor Who story that he eventually brought elements of into life, the universe, and everything.
Third Hitchhiker's
book. There was something with the Cricket Men and all that stuff had to do with a story that he tried to do with Doctor Who or something. I don't know. But there's another thing that Adams was trying to do that he ended up recycling stuff for one of the Hitchhiker's books. But so he's doing all that, and that was pretty much, it seemed to be, he was known as this character, and that was his thing.
Yeah,
and
he has very, very, like he plays, when you look at his IMDb, he's the Doctor Who in a lot of things like that aren't like Jim will fix it and, you know, like Powder Crit. Like he's got all these little things, and he was even doing commercials as the Doctor.
The Australian ones, right? The ones that him and Lala Ward?
For computers and such, yeah.
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 Yeah, so I guess we should point that out, that at one point Lala Ward shows up as the second incarnation of Romana, and they get a romance going, and then they get married, and, you know, 18 months later, all, whatever it is.
By all accounts, it is tempestuous.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. They seem miserable, and he also, I don't think he was a good person, a good husband to be married, but I think the drinking probably didn't help. And
one of the beautiful things he said, though, and again, this is credit to his kind of certain view of life, is some things just they burn brightly, but not for a long time. He's completely made his peace, and I don't know how Lala Ward feels about that, but
I noticed, you know, it's funny because he's interviewed in those CDs I mentioned, and they eventually come round to her. And while he's very complimentary, and what a bright, amazing woman that she is, but he doesn't really say, you know, we were married for a while, you know, and that didn't really, he doesn't touch on it. He doesn't talk about it. And I saw her in an interview once where somebody mentioned it or something, and then she said, and what did Tom say? And the interviewer's like, well, he didn't really say anything. He didn't mention. And she said, well, he didn't. And she goes, no, that sounds about right. That's pretty much what I'd expect. I mean, I don't even know. It's a couple of these stories that I picked up, she's, you know, Lala Ward is playing Romana in the story, but I don't know if they're even in the same room recording this stuff, because they're certainly not being interviewed together afterwards or anything. And the other thing that I think is really trippy, because at one point he talks about Richard Dawkins, and then in a very roundabout kind of, oh, come on, really? You're not positive. Like, I think actually they got married. You know, like, you know the story. You know, Douglas Adams knew both of them, introduces Lala Ward, you know, brings her to a party that Richard Dawkins is going to be at.
Yeah.
He knew her from Doctor Who. And, you know, she ends up marrying Richard Dawkins. But the way Baker kind of talked about it was like, I think, but she, well, you know that Lala Ward is married. It's like, oh, really? Just like, I just read this yesterday. Like, of course you know what's going on. You know, so.
But that really does jive with his weird, he can be an oddball. And, you know, Peter Davison recently gave an interview where it's like Peter Davison's just out of, he doesn't give a shit anymore.
Totally, in that interview, he doesn't care.
Yeah.
He so doesn't care.
And
oh, my God.
it seems that, you know, the two main targets of his candidness are the Bakers, Colin and Tom, and he's much kinder to Colin. He kind of feels sorry for him, but he's had it with Tom Baker, and it's hilarious because he's like, you know, apparently Peter Davison is the only doctor, living doctor, anyone that Tom Baker will be photographed with at conventions. And
oh, that's funny.
And you know, Peter Davison's like, and you know, he'll tell it right to his face because he doesn't care, but he's like, I don't really know what that's about. I think that's about that he doesn't view me as a threat, you know.
Well, he also is good at pointing out what he tries to say. It's at one point in there where, like, he's trying to say, you know, I was a good sport 20th anniversary when I was the guy and he had to be the last guy out or have his own day. I was a good sport at the 30th thing, or I was a good sport or whatever.
Yeah.
Now here it is the 50th and we're doing this thing, and they wanted to do the introduction where Tom Baker was the last name read out, whoever was going to come on. And he went to the people, he said, no, absolutely not. He gets read, and then my name gets read, and then it goes up.
Yeah, he's trying to be chronological about it.
Yeah, and he's like, I've been cool about this many times, but this is bullshit. Like, it's been 30 years, so no, next.
Beautiful picture of, you know, Matt Smith and Sylvester McCoy and Colin Baker with the Queen.
Yeah.
And they're all looking at one side, and of course Tom is to the left looking the other way.
Yeah.
And that just clearly infuriated Peter Davis.
Yeah, and he's also, I mean, there's like stories of the you know, I get it now with the five doctors, the 20th anniversary thing. I understand.
I totally understand why he didn't want to be a part of it.
He didn't want to be part of it. I think part of it was I just left. And part of it, I think, was a big FU John Nathan Turner.
Like, absolutely.
You kidding me? You told me to, you know, you kicked me out and you were a nightmare. I'm not doing your stupid show because you want me to really do it really badly. But then he does the long lead thing. And he gets his own, like, he would not be on stage with the rest of them.
Yeah.
And I saw in an interview, like, Gareth Edwards or somebody mentioned it together, was like, well, he's kind of uptight about that. And he goes, I don't know what it is, but I remember being, you know, either hearing a story or being backstage with Tom Baker somewhere. And someone said, are you going to go out with the, and he said, oh, no. I was like, who are these people? I don't know who these people, what are they? as if he's kind of saying, you know, like, they're not the doctor. Like, I'm the guy, you know, like, I mean, partially probably being a wise ass, but also really thinking, you know, I really am the shit. And, you know, it's sad because, and again, this tells you how identified he was with the part. Davison, in that same interview, talks about the wilderness for Tom. Like, Tom Baker found it really difficult, I think, to get work after Doctor Who because he was only seen as that character. He got work.
He did. And the most famous story I read was, I think he was doing a play. He mentions in a famous interview where he walks in and he's got his big head of hair, and the women at the front counter are giggling with him and enjoying him, and then he gets his hair cut for the part.
Right.
And he walks out and says, goodbye, ladies, and they all go, who the hell's that?
Right.
And now, let's bring that up, the post-Doctor Who years. I want to go back and talk about the early stuff because there's some great stuff in the early stuff. But he tries his hand, and I remember this because at this point by 84, that's 3 years after Doctor Who. But for me, it was like, you know, he had just left.
Right.
He tries his hand at the U.S., and of course we both remember Remington Steele. Where he played Anatole Blaylock. I think he's an international thief.
Yes.
And, you know, they put him in a trench coat. There's kind of a little synergy to Doctor Who there.
And he barely speaks.
I remember
being so excited for that episode.
Yeah, me too.
And he barely speaks. And I think it was in one of the Who Club newsletters or something, there were photos. And I thought, so now he's going to break in America.
I thought that too.
He did a couple of things. You know what? Didn't he also do like a Robin Hood comedy?
Yeah, it was
TV
called,
movie?
It was a schleppy series. I don't know if it was a pilot or what, called The Zany Adventures of Robin Hood. I remember George Segal as Robin Hood.
Yes.
And, yes. You know, Roddy McDowell, one of our favorites, is Prince John. Oh, my God.
I think it was a pilot, like a 90-minute pilot or something.
And Tom Baker is Sir Guy de Gisborne. I remember that.
That's right. That would have been like 84, 85 or something?
That was 84, and then he went right back to England.
Yep.
And he did a lot of stuff. But yeah, like
he was on the Blackadder. He did season two of Blackadder.
He did one episode of the She-Devil TV miniseries that was later made into a movie. He narrates stuff. I remember him from The Silver Chair, which is C.S. Lewis. He plays Puddle Glum. I remember catching
that. That's right. He was in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe series.
Yeah, I should have been in class when I was watching that because that's when I'm in college. But he really just disappears.
Yeah.
And he actually, I think this, in 92, there's a TV version of Clue in England. And I found some. I think I sent you the YouTube of it because I was fascinated by it, where he's Professor Plum.
No, I don't think he did send me that, but I'll look it up.
Yeah, there was a Clue game show with actors, and he's Professor Plum. Can you imagine that?
A game show?
Yeah, well, it's like a game show, but it was like a staged. You have to see it.
Okay.
But in the UK, they call Clue Cluedo. I don't know why that is.
Well, I think, I don't know. I've never understood that either. He also started to do more stage work.
He absolutely
did. I remember when I was there, when I was in London in 1990, I think, an actor called Tom Conti did a famous sort of almost a one-man thing called Jeffrey Bernard is Unwell about the boozy writer. And I think Baker did that as well a few years after that he did a run somewhere. So I think he was doing more stage stuff. But then
he got a TV run in the UK on a show called The Doc. What, not The Doc. Medics, ironically.
Medics, and then he was on the show Monarch of the Glen, which was really big for him. That was a big... He was a regular character on that. Suddenly he was really visible. And I think right around the same time came Little Britain. Like that suddenly was this amazing turning point where...
And again, another hilarious thing by him where he goes, now I'm being hired by the children I entertained.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, he also did... right around there, but I'm going to say like 99 or 2000 maybe, Charlie Higson, who was part of the main two guys from the Fast show, which is Charlie Higson and Paul Whitehouse. He, after the Fast show, and they kind of said, what do you guys want to do? You can do whatever. Higson did a new version of Randall and Hopper Deceased.
Oh, right. I remember that. Yeah.
With Mortimer and Wise. They were the characters. And then Tom Baker was the guy that's sort of in heaven that guides Hopkirk through how to make contact with people on Earth and stuff like that.
And of course, all
his stuff was in the studio. But again, it was, Higson going, let's use this guy and he also, I think Higson also had a character in the Fast show called Swiss Tony. A used car salesman, hilarious character. They did a spinoff show, Swiss Tony, and Baker showed up in an episode of that too. So Higson's clearly a big fan of Tom Baker.
Another famous fan of Tom Baker is Peter Jackson, who wanted him for Lord of the Rings, but Baker refused. He didn't want to.
What was he busy?
He didn't want to spend 8 months in New Zealand, according to the interviews. But, he did the next best thing. He did the dollar store version of Lord of the Rings, and he was in Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes.
Did you not drop your beverage when he just pops into that?
I don't know if I ever saw it.
You have to see that movie only for Jeremy Irons' amazing scenery chewing.
So I did hear that he's like incredible. Unbelievably over the top.
Is not, and it's almost to the point where it's perfect. Like it's
well, I just great. Remember, like the lead guy was like, "Who's this Nick Jr. kid? Who the hell is that guy?" That's the lead.
He was
of the
Jimmy
movie.
Olsen on Lois and Clark. Nobody remembers that.
I don't remember. I don't even remember Lois and Clark, frankly.
Why do I?
I thought it was about the explorers. It took me a season to figure out it wasn't about. It was Lois and Clark. not Lewis and Clark.
And of course,
but
Marlon Wayans.
Yeah, so he did that. So then Little Britain becomes this
phenomenon.
You know, Fast Show was sort of riffing on the idea that you could just sort of have a catchphrase that you knew was coming in the sketch, and every sketch ended the same. You know, every time you saw that character, you go, I know how this thing is going to end. It riffed on that, and then Little Britain took it even further than that. But he ends up becoming this, you know, as soon as you heard his voice in the first scene, you're like, oh my God, that's good. It was a radio show first, I think. Like a lot of stuff over there. And I think he
yeah, I
the
think
radio
you're right.
Thing.
And then he just ended up doing it. And he's hilarious. I mean, his narration
is
fantastic because, again, he's so straight-faced.
And I think
around the late 90s, he did that god-awful Dimensions in Time. John Nathan Turner. And I guess he had reconciled with John Nathan Turner because through Nicholas Courtney, they became friends.
Right.
And again, I want to point out, Tom is not acting with the other doctors.
No, he's just somebody went into a bathroom, rolled a camera, did a white screen around it or something, and he's, you know, it's, there are no words to describe just how awful that thing is. And why anybody let John Nathan Turner within 50 feet of doing anything for the show again, I don't understand. But that is one of the most awful things ever. And Baker's in it for about 4 seconds at the very beginning or something. But then he ends up, remember they did those Radio Times covers? Was that back then? Or when was
it?
They did like the six different or seven, you know, just before the show came back, they each had their own cover and then you could like put them all together kind of thing. But you're right, they weren't in the same room or anything. He wouldn't dare. And then they say the Little Britain thing, right around that same time that he's suddenly kind of back in the consciousness. Again, this is before the show comes back. At this point, he hasn't even started doing Big Finish, because that didn't happen until about 6 or 7 years ago, I don't think. When he finally said, okay, you know what, I'm these things are going so well, I'm interested now in maybe playing the Doctor again, which was a huge boon for Big Finish, but... he ends up, his persona ends up getting riffed on the radio show Dead Ringers, the people that do the impressions, all those Brits that do these amazing impressions of characters. And there's a guy, John Culshaw, who does a dead-on Tom Baker, you know, doing crank calls on the Dead Ringers show, which then they bring into the live-action show. And there's actually a clip, it's an amazing clip, of John Culshaw in a little bit of makeup as an older Tom Baker sitting in a pub talking to Tom Baker, like doing, you know, dueling voices, which is pretty amazing. So he's, you know, he starts to get back into consciousness with that stuff. And the next thing was the Big Finish stuff. All of a sudden, he was open to doing stuff with his doctor and you know, doing those CDs. Wasn't that the next thing? Wouldn't that have been the next thing that happened?
What era are we talking about? You kind of, was that around the late 90s?
I'm going to say that him, well, late 90s was like the Little Britain and the Dead Ringers thing. And then the Big Finish stuff, I think, was like early, maybe mid-2000s.
So I never followed much. You know,
no, me either. I just knew that it was a big deal that suddenly he was willing to play the character again and do some CDs.
I can honestly remember I was getting back into Doctor Who in the late 1990s, you know, after a little bit of a break, and I was picking up Doctor Who monthlies, and I was fascinated that he was being interviewed in them, and they were taking this kind of pedantic tone with him, where, you know, they didn't seem to trust him, you know, whether he'd say the right thing.
Right.
And there was some really and that's when I first discovered I got his autobiography, and I never realized he was kind of an oddball, like he was kind of a strange guy.
Well, I'll go further. Did you ever read the book that he wrote, The Boy Who Kicked Pigs?
No, I did not.
Oh boy, that's a tough one to get through. That is some really dark shit. And, you know, I think he's, you know, well, every one of these interviews, you know, at the end of a Big Finish, there's a 10-minute interview with Tom Baker. At the end of the other thing. There's an interview. Then there's this Tom Baker at 80 or whatever. Within the first couple of questions, he brings God into it somewhere.
Yeah, well, that's not a big surprise.
How wrong the Bible got it. Like, it's constantly... So when one of the things Davison would say in that interview was, I don't know if Tom just doesn't remember telling me certain stories or what his methodology, but he'll sit down next to me and tell me the same story he told me 20 minutes ago. And you're like, are you messing with me? Like, why are you doing this? Like, if he just kind of, you know, not paying attention or doesn't, you know, thinks you're kind of beneath him or I don't know what. But, you know, like, he seems to... I know that he and Elizabeth Sladen were pretty close, and I know that he was really heartbroken when she died.
Yeah, and there was a nice bond there, and it's really shown in the commentaries, too, where they just seem to be getting on very nicely.
That would have been the first thing. I take it back.
Yeah.
Not the big finish stuff. He started to do things like...
Commentaries.
You know, commentaries, and I remember the first thing being Shada. So they finally decided to release Shada on videotape. And the stuff that was missing, he sat down with a script and read through some of it or gave some linking material. He sat in a studio, you know, with a bunch of creatures and stuff. So that was kind of when I went, oh, yeah, so he's going to start doing stuff.
Around that time, I think he did the Best of Tom Baker VHSs, too. Remember that?
Yes. Yes, that's right. And then I think he might have done some of the nights when the BBC would do, like, Doctor Who Night or something. I don't remember. But he seemed to be more open to talking about it and being involved. And then, of course, he shows up on all the, you know, the commentaries and the documentaries and the DVDs and stuff like that. I've got the UK set that I don't know if it got released here, but it's the 50th anniversary, like, Tom Baker set. It's in a special big long box, and it comes with, like, his regeneration figure when he's dressed in Pertwee's clothes.
Oh, yeah.
And a sonic screwdriver, a copy of Genesis of the Daleks, and, you know, some other odds and ends, like a letter from him, it's postcards, things like that. And then there's a DVD that's like a sit-down, you know, 30-minute thing with him talking about his career, what this show meant to him, and just him sitting in front of a fireplace, and it's pretty great, you know. But he's a one-off. He's one of those guys. It's like he didn't do well. Also, I should say this is interesting too to throw in. So I don't know how this happened exactly, but there's a guy named Paul Mars, who is the guy that when they finally decided, you know, let's go back and do radio as if their radio shows will adapt the rest of the Hitchhiker books. We'll get the original cast together from the original radio shows and then do a set of, you know, CDs that are just like the original radio shows, but for the next three books. Paul Mars was the guy that adapted all of them. And then he ended up adapting the Dirk Gently books. Harry Enfield played Dirk Gently on the audio things. Well, I don't know how this connection happened, but apparently Tom Baker had this idea of wanting to do something original. I think he really is starting to talk about and feel like death is around the corner, where it would be fun to play on his persona, not ever mention Doctor Who, but it's about Tom Baker, and the whole thing kicks off at his funeral, and all these people that used to work with him reminiscing on, you know, who he is, and then, you know, how did he die? How did you hear that he died? And they're called Baker's End. And so there are three of them, and I've listened to two of them. And Baker's in it, and Katie Manning is the woman that was like his companion on whatever this science fiction show was. But you can just tell how much stuff in this is coming out of Tom Baker's head. And a lot of it has to do with the afterlife, and, you know, between these two things and the interview with him, that Tom Baker at 80, you really get a sense of just how kind of tired he is, and just sort of, yeah, I'm ready, you know, like, I'm, you know. I'm ready. I've had a good life, and I did good. You know, I had some good times, and, you know, he really—he's apparently got an amazing memory for stuff.
Yeah, but he's still apparently very salient, and has all his capacity.
Yeah, I mean,
and he's still working. I mean, he's doing Star Wars Rebels right now.
Yes, that's right. That man, talk about one of those things that you just go. You know, we always talk about those two universes coming together, like Sean Connery, you know, being in the third Indiana Jones, or, you know, you know, McCartney working with Paul Weller and Noel Gallagher, whatever those things are that I go, wow, I never thought. To have Tom Baker come into the Star Wars universe is so insane to me, because those two things meant so much to me as a kid. And he's amazing on the show as that creature. It's just perfect. I mean, somebody paid attention to it. That's who we need to get. You know, just freaking
so
perfect.
We kind of went by some really key stuff. And there's, if I had to pick my favorite Tom Baker stuff, it's all around the time when he was cast as Doctor Who. Actually, you know, his later stuff is great. I love Little Britain, but there's three things that I really love about Tom Baker, and that is Golden Voyage of Sinbad.
Okay.
Because he plays the main villain in the film, and I always feel a great doctor can always play a great villain. That's why I was so happy about Peter Capaldi. I really hated Peter Capaldi when I saw him in Torchwood. And I thought, this guy will be able to play a fantastic Doctor Who.
Right.
I don't know if you remember Golden Voyage of Sinbad, but it's one of my personal favorites. John Philip Law, who's a huge favorite actor of mine, is Sinbad.
Yes.
Of course, it's a Harryhausen film. I think it's the second Sinbad film, and it's
Is it 73 or 75?
73, yeah. It's my 73? Favorite. It's my favorite of the three. And Baker's fantastic as evil Prince Kura.
And then isn't Troughton in the 77 one? Is he in that one?
I think you're right.
Right?
Troughton is in Jason and the Argonauts. And
he is?
He is. He
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
But, you know, no, I don't know. I think you might be right. Yes, he is in. That's the one with Patrick Wayne. He is also in Sinbad and the Ragged Tiger.
Eye of the Tiger. I was going to say Seven and the Ragged Tiger, but I think that's Duran Duran.
That's not my favorite Sinbad. That is, of course, Marvel Comics adapted that one, if you remember. And it's just, you know, it's easily my favorite Sinbad film, if not.
Great in it.
Yeah, Baker. He really is.
And they put him in kind of slightly older makeup. He's got a big beard.
Yeah.
You know, he's not...
Well, he's getting older, too. It's aging him, the right. magic. Yeah. So that's a fabulous turn for Baker. And you see a little bit of Prince Kura occasionally in his performance of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
The next film I like to talk about, and this is one I had to track down. I don't think I saw it until I was in my 20s. But it's just a dreary little rainy British film called The Mutations.
Okay.
And weirdly enough, Baker plays a mutant in it.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I've never seen it, but I know what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. It's just one of those dark kind of films that it's low budget. Donald Pleasance is the lead, and it's basically a scientist just experiments on people. And then he throws them in the circus sideshow when he's done.
Right. And
Baker's pure evil in this. He's the right-hand man of Donald Pleasance. He himself is... what am I looking for here? He's got... I don't know what you'd call him if he's... he's got mutated features.
Right.
So he wears a big trench coat, a scarf, and a big floppy hat to disguise himself.
That's great.
There's a beautiful...
Well, wasn't he in the Hammer one, too? Like,
no, he wasn't in the Hammer one. No, it was
Amicus?
Amicus is the Vault of Horror.
The Vault of Horror, that's it. He's an artist, right?
He's wearing
his
Prince Kura beard again. And he's an artist. Yeah, he's an artist
kind of
who...
a beatnik artist.
Yeah, like a bohemian artist who...
Yeah, bohemian, yeah.
Paints revenge on his critics, right? So
That's right.
And then he paints himself, but he's in this apartment with no air conditioning, and the painting melts.
Right.
So he does himself in, and of course, you know, they all discover...
His face melts.
Hope there's no spoilers for anyone. They all find out the hell at the end of Vault of Horror.
Well, now that's a spoiler.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Now I don't even remember that. Now I can't watch the movie again.
Yeah, well, you know, in about 3 weeks you'll forget that one. And of course, he has a weird cameo in Frankenstein: The True Story, the That's the, I think it's a two-part one. That's the one with Jane Seymour.
With Sarazen? Michael Sarazen, that
yeah,
one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Bacon's I remember in 1984, that played on two nights on Buffalo 29, and I sat through the whole friggin' thing to see Tom Baker as a sea captain. That's how bored I was.
I don't remember that. I almost picked that up like a month ago.
Yeah.
I found it at Amoeba, and I almost got it.
Pleasant little surprise. Your favorite, James Mason's in it as well.
Does he play as if they've squashed anyone's piece? It's for
Dr. Pondari.
Yes. Don't smudge your toenails.
Yes.
I almost picked that up like a month ago. I hadn't seen it since I was... That thing freaked me out, that miniseries, the Frankenstein thing, because it was pretty graphic, if I remember.
Doesn't he rip Jane Seymour's head off?
I mean, can you blame him? She's just too beautiful. No, I don't remember that. I remember like things with legs and heads and arms and things being in jars, maybe, or maybe I'm getting it mixed up, you know? Because that's, again, when you think about like Morbius, there's some really dark stuff. I mean, that was their Frankenstein homage, you know? But you know, when you think about it, because we're talking about, there's something about him. There's something about his face, his features, his height, whatever it is. He did dip into a lot of genre stuff before he even got the part, which is unusual, kind of. And there's something about whatever he gives off that you go, well, that'll be an eccentric character. That'll be an interesting, you know. He wasn't quite leading man, you know, handsome. He's got larger features and stuff. So it's a little confusing how people, what they pigeonholed him as, and then, of course, the choice to make him this guy. But, you know, the scripts were so good in his early days, and he had such a control of the character.
Yeah.
Before, you know, he knew just how to turn up with a little bit of wacky, and just enough of a non sequitur and a little bit of a, you know, looking in the face of danger and whatever, before it got too big. Before it got, you know, he got too big in the next couple of years. Those first two were like the perfect chemical combination of great writing and him completely controlling that character. It's remarkable to me where he got the guidance to take it. He clearly, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, don't you think that's an example of someone sort of making it their own? I mean,
absolutely.
You know, Roger Moore, I mean, Lazenby as well, but, you know, Roger Moore had to follow Sean Connery, and Roger Moore was going to be Roger Moore. He was never going to be as tough as Connery. Everyone knew what they were going to get. You know, everyone after that has had to try to make it their own some way and not do an impression of what's come before. But with the Doctor, it's like he truly made that thing his own. It was, it was, you know, 80-90% of it was completely unlike what came before it.
And I mean, that was, you know, the testament to it is he is still the longest running Doctor.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. He just is. You know, it's hard to even say, because to a lot of people, Roger Moore is their Bond, you know? I mean, he was my Bond as a kid, you know, but Connery is, you know, we don't have a lot of stuff where you can go, no, he was the best, you know? The Doctor is a really unique character where you can easily have favorites, but I mean, over the years, I don't even think with the new show, it's really changed that Baker, worldwide, Baker would still be the guy that is the Doctor.
Yeah.
Everyone else is a lot,
there's a lot of firsts there. Even if you look at merchandise, you know, first, you know, Doctor Who magazine, it was him on the cover.
That's right.
When Doctor Who got his first comic published in the United States, it was him on the cover. Marvel Premiere.
That's right. The Marvel Premiere, yes.
You know how hard I looked for that?
Yeah, I looked for it too. Because I remember the reason I knew it even existed was, again, art with Starlog magazine.
Yeah,
it was a blurb in Starlog, and it showed the cover.
Yeah, that awesome cover.
Great cover.
I still have those stories. Those stories are great. The Iron Legion, and then there's the ones about the emotions.
Dave Gibbons.
Yeah.
Dave Gibbons was doing the
I think they got like Walter Simonson to do the covers. Somebody really gifted.
He's like floating in the sky with the TARDIS behind him and the big star. It's amazing cover. Yeah.
And then you
so
have...
Yeah, so that was a first. So the magazine's a first. The toys...
First action toy figure line. Of the Doctor.
Yes,
you know,
right.
Like everything prior to that was mostly Daleks.
Yes.
He got his own. He got his own Halloween costume in England with a Berwick Tom Baker play suit. Now, apparently,
that's right.
That sold like zero units. Apparently,
he got a yo-yo. He got a face on a yo-yo. The logo on a yo-yo. That's a really good point.
Yeah,
that's a really good point though, because while there was merchandise,
yeah,
you know, cigarette, you know, candy cigarette cards and annuals and things like that. As far as toys went, really, it was the Daleks. There was a mechanoid that was made, and there was when Hartnell, with his picture on the side, there was a plastic TARDIS bank, police box bank. But to do anything outside of Daleks, he was already so popular by 76, 77, that they gave him an entire range of action figures to go with his Doctor. That was huge.
Absolutely.
That was a big deal. You know,
and a board game that sold poorly, so they put a sticker of Tom Baker on the box.
That's right. Was it Strawberry Fair? Was that or Dennis Fisher? Strawberry
Fair. That was Denny Fisher, yeah.
Denny Fisher. And also the very first, which I've talked about, I think. The very first, I don't remember quite when or how, but I knew it was before my first trip to London as a kid, because I didn't know who the hell Peter Davison was when I got that Easter egg box. My very first piece of anything of Doctor Who was the TARDIS tin, the little tin money box with Baker in the doorway.
Yeah.
It's a photo of his face, but the body's painted. It's horribly done.
It's horribly done. That's why I chose the Davison one, even though I didn't like Davison that much.
But that was my TARDIS. That was the only...
Yeah, I had that bank as well.
...thing resembling a toy, and I've still got it. I mean, so that thing is marked 1980, so I must have got it not long after that. I don't know how I got it. I think I mailed away for it somehow.
I did the same, yeah.
But that was a big piece of merchandise for the show. Like, that thing was everywhere. Everybody had that thing. And they just never had a machine behind the show to merchandise it properly. They did stuff, but they never... It wasn't until... I mean, even when the... You know, until the show came back and they started to see what the potential was when it came back. Before that, you had Product Enterprise. They made a talking Tom Baker, you know, along with...
That was out of the blue. They had a talking Tom Baker doll. Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, because they did it loads of Daleks, and all of a sudden the Tom Baker, like, holy shit, they're doing a...
Yeah.
Tom Baker thing. And I don't know,
grinning maniacally. That's one of the things that I've always loved about your Doctor Who doll, Biff Bang Pow's, is it isn't just grinning.
Isn't it what now?
It wasn't grinning. It looks like the opening credits, the stoic opening credits.
That's exactly what I wanted it to be. I wanted those to be sort of riffing on the Dennis Fisher stuff, but also that's who I think of. When I think of Tom Baker as Doc, I go back to those stories and I think of his face in the opening credits.
Yeah.
Not the big googly, you know, big goofy eyes and the big, big grin. He's this mysterious sort of guy that's kind of above it all. Like, he's sort of the smartest guy in the room, but he's not blowing into the room the way he did, you know, a few seasons in. So that... You know, there's that great shot. We talked about this in the Doctor Who show. I think we did this. But there's that great shot, the opening shot of Pyramids of Mars, when they come into the TARDIS and Baker's head is down. He's wearing the fedora and his head is down toward the ground, and he slowly raises his head up and he's kind of got a grimace on and he's got his hand in his pocket.
Oh, Walk in Eternity, yeah.
And the camera pulls back and Sarah Jane comes and goes, what's your... You know, I'm a Time Lord, you know? I walk in eternity. You know, he starts going on about how...
She's mocking him.
He's feeling restless, and she's mocking him. That's the image I get of him. That, to me, is the coolest, you know, the coolest that he was. So that's what I wanted the figures to be. But I have to say, I wanted to tell this little story real quick. I had another interesting eBay experience
Oh, no.
Well, we started, you know, all the Tom Baker stuff started getting into my head again, and I started to look up, because you got the big chief Capaldi figure.
Yeah, I bought the big chief Capaldi figure in a, probably a fit of alcohol-ridden impulse, and it's really neat.
This is slightly similar. I started looking for the big chief Tom Baker figure.
I could never find
And boy, I found it, and I paid a couple bucks.
Oh, you know, really?
Not a million, but, you know, it's gorgeous. I mean, this thing is, and I thought, if I wait too much longer, because they only made like 1,200 of them or something, or 1,000.
Yeah, like, they're impossible to find now.
It's going to be really tough to find. So yeah. I grabbed what I did. The guy I got it from was super cool, and then I get it. It shows up, and it, you know, one of the things that it comes with are these multiple little accessories, and it's really beautiful, like the detail and the scarf and the, you know, the vest. I mean, everything. It's just great. One of the things it comes with is the key to time put together in a cube. I think you can separate some pieces. I forget. And then it also comes with the little stick, you know, the little finder that they had.
Yeah.
Looking for it, and you can put that inside the top of the square. So I get this thing, and I'm looking at all the bits, and I can't find the little stick, the little finder stick. And I'm checking the box and the wrapping and the stuff, every layer of the thing, and looking in the box. I can't find this thing. Like, what? It should be right there in the tray, but it's not there. So I wrote to the guy, and I said, hey, listen, the thing is great. Thanks for getting it so quickly, and it looks beautiful. For some reason, I can't find the thing. It's not. I don't think it's here. I don't think it was in it. Do you possibly have it laying around? Yada, yada. Well, his name, you know, well, I've got the envelope here. It's DJ Wheeler is his name in the UK. And he wrote back and said, no, I don't. That's really odd that it's not there. It hasn't really come out of the tray. It doesn't make any sense. But he said, don't worry. And he went to some event the next weekend. I forget. He didn't really explain how it happened, but he went to some event or did something where he was able to get in touch with Big Chief and get the little stick. And he got, and then, you know, the following week he said, no worries, I got it. I'll ship it out to you, or have them ship it to you or something. And I got it. I got it in an envelope, in a little padded envelope. He tracked it down and sent me the little stick that was missing. So I wanted to just call him out on air and say thank you so much. Really cool to go the extra mile.
You run into folks like that, and it makes you so happy, because they're not, you know, they're not the norm, and they should be.
Yeah, you're right. And I don't know how he got it. I don't know. He made it sound like he was going to, well, I'm going to see, you know, Big Chief over the weekend, and I'll, you know, ask them about it and see if they have an extra one. And whatever he did, he got one. Wow. And I it's now complete. So
I really wish I could get a hands on this Tom Baker, but I don't think I have the stones right now to buy one. So
well, let's just say that someday I'm probably going to regret it. But for now, you know, it's just, I just figured the other one seemed to me slightly larger runs than this one. I don't know what it is, but
I don't get it either. You think they would, you know, up their game?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
but you know you'll get the Pertwee if they do a Pertwee.
Oh, I never thought about it. Yeah,
I can't see you not getting a Pertwee.
And of course, I can only imagine three Colin Bakers.
right. Various stages of weight gain.
I feel so bad for him.
Sorry, I know. That was a terrible thing to say.
He's by every account, a sweet man.
He tried so hard. And I told you, I met him. He couldn't have been more delightful to me.
Yeah.
You know, it was a trip meeting him. But man, when you look back on those, they were so,
yeah.
He tried so hard, and he had so little to work with, you know. Yeah,
bad stories.
Just madness.
Yeah.
But we thought that would be a fun subject, was to cover Tom Baker. I mean, obviously the bulk of that is Doctor Who, but he's done many things, including an autobiography, Who is Tom Baker? Get it?
Yes. Which has a horrifying scene where he discusses childhood masturbation.
Good old Tom. Yeah, doesn't he talk about the nudity, his nudity in Canterbury Tales too, or something in that?
I don't remember that. I remember he talks about his mother used to drink like 80 cups of tea a day, and like, you know, you don't know where you're going with any of this, right?
No.
I think there's something written to the point of, you know, he had a family at one time and left his family and then became an actor and was estranged from his children and actually, like, bumped into his son at a New Zealand pub, like,
oh my God.
30 years later.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I don't remember that. I'll have to look at this book again. I've got a signed copy.
Yeah, I do too. I think it's harder to find an unsigned copy.
And I actually got when I was a kid, I had a, this is a, talk about it. You know, you talk about your playground stories, weirdness and stuff.
Yeah.
This is a weird one. I had a pen pal. I don't know, the magazine or something, however, a British pen pal.
Okay.
That would get me, you know, annuals, old annuals, and send them, and I would find him American stuff or
books or whatever. Oh, yeah, I had an Australian pen pal like that, yeah.
Yeah, and we were pen pals for a while, for like a couple of years. I mean, of course, it was mainly just about the show, and he was as good as the internet telling me what's going on over there because I didn't find out till later, and what's with the cancellation and all that stuff.
We had a Doctor Who magazine here that was consisted mainly of like photocopied British Radio Times articles.
You know,
like that would be like the Doctor Who, I think it was called Enlightenment after the.
That sounds right. I recognize that.
The most boring story ever. and it was, it was just that. It was just like a lot of photocopied articles from the newspaper and the Radio Times.
Well, this guy would write 5 or 6 page letters. And eventually it was kind of like, well, hey, you know, we've been writing back and forth and, you know, trading stuff or whatever, and maybe you should get to know each other better. Like, what do you dig? What do you hate? I was like 12, you know, 13 or something. I wasn't trying to say like anything heavy, like, you know, where you go when you're going to die. But I don't know, within that conversation, I think it's the penny finally dropped and he realized that I was like 13.
Yeah.
And then the letters just started to get less and less frequent. He was probably going, oh, shit, I've been talking to a child for the past...
Am I on a database?
2 years. And he just kind of slammed, like, why is it? I thought he was going to send another book. Nothing showed up again. He probably just changed his address and got the hell out of there. So I got some cool stuff from him. Like some of the BBC postcards from the early 80s and stuff, at the different, you know, because it was nothing. It was absolutely nothing. And he managed to, as a surprise, before he knew I was a child, he got me a BBC postcard that Tom Baker had signed. And
oh,
on the
cool.
front, so it's from about 78. And on the place where you write, you know, it's like someone had typed, you know, dear, you know, Patrick or whatever. I mean, thank you so much for your letter, blah, blah, blah. And then he did his autograph on the front. So it's from postmark like 79, 78 or 79. So
very cool.
This guy got it for me. Yeah. But and also just a footnote, when we were launching, I shall refrain from saying anything critical about the BBC, but when we were launching our figure line, the first year we did it, and then the second year, we begged the BBC, like, you got to be doing something. The anniversary's coming up. Let's get Tom Baker. Let's have those conversations. You know, what's it going to cost? You know, get him on a plane, etc. And their response, I remember we tried and tried and tried, and their response was, we're not interested in really celebrating the past. We just want to concentrate on this universe of Doctor Who. We're not really interested in the... Like, oh, okay, great idea. He would have been mobbed at San Diego Comic-Con. It would have
Absolutely.
Been insane.
Yeah.
But, no, they didn't want to... I mean, we had to beg, you know... I remember the Product Enterprise guys starting to bitch because they wanted the new taxicab logo from 2005 on the packaging of their Sonic Screwdriver replica. Which they said didn't make any sense. It was Tom Baker's, and why would you want to? But they wanted a uniform thing. So, for the quote, classic stuff that finally came out from Character Options to have the Pertwee logo is a bit of a miracle because, you know, they didn't want anything associated with the older show. It all had to have this uniform look. So when we did the black and white TARDIS bobble 50th anniversary and used the original logo on the packaging and the base, and then I did a set of coasters with the different logos from the different doctors on each of them. I mean, that was, you know, fighting tooth and nail to make it happen, to celebrate the history, but they didn't want to. But, you know, it's the, you know, water under the bridge, right?
Absolutely.
Not really, but sort of.
No.
But there you go.
Let's not go to the past.
There's a good one. There's a good...
Yeah.
And we got lots more lined up. We have a lot of subjects that we're keeping track of that we want to cover, and some guests we'd like to have and talk about different
things. Yeah, we're gonna get more into the swing of this. I apologize for the podcastless March. That was actually a combination of things. One, I was going through some medical stuff, and also my computer decided it no longer wished to record podcasts of any kind. So
So
two of those, just the twain met, and Jason was the victim caught in the middle of this struggle. So,
story of my life.
And we're going to be much more frequent in the future. I think I've said this before. That sounds like very familiar.
Well, it's, but, you know, we'll keep saying it until we get it perfect, until we get it right. That's what we're here for. All right, well, we hope you enjoyed that, and we haven't lost you along the way with our
thanks very much again for tuning in, and keep the comments coming, and all the wonderful things said on YouTube and Facebook. We read them all.
Yeah, thanks so much.